ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of the Politics Now podcast. And navigating what our rapidly changing world means can be tricky.
I do think you're right to point to the ability of the backbench in Britain to agitate, be upset with Keir Starmer. That's one of the reasons he's gone.
That's why I'm joined by the sharpest political minds at the ABC to break down what each development means for Australia and how the government is positioning.
Albanese has got a much more compliant backbench and he's got much more dominance of the parliament just because of peculiar Australian features of our system.
That's Politics Now with me, Patricia Carvelis. Find it on ABC Listen.
A disruptive AI model from Chinese startup Moonshot has put pressure on Silicon Valley-backed platforms like Anthropic and OpenAI, and markets have taken notice. Could these sort of tech moves in China drag the highly valued SpaceX, the NASDAQ, and more back down to earth? And could a lack of housing supply be keeping downsizers from finding new homes? And could easing stamp duty solve that problem? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Daniel Ziffer.
And I'm Ian Verrender, the ABC Chief Business Correspondent.
Ian, lovely to chat as ever. Some exciting, interesting news. There's a new AI model from a Chinese startup called Moonshot. It's called Kimi K3. It's an open source AI system, so it's going to be out there broadly shortly. And it could rival those Silicon Valley funded models that we've been talking about and some employers are using, like Anthropic and OpenAI. To start with, what's been the market reaction?
Overnight, very little. Wall Street was relatively calm about this, but on Friday night, we saw some fairly heavy selling on Wall Street. And of course, we saw the Korean market, the Kospi, drop quite sharply yesterday. It was shut on Friday, so there was a bit of a catch-up session there. It was off between 4 and 5%. So some fairly heavy falls there. And we've seen, of course, massive falls on that Korean market in the past few weeks.
What happened?
The South Korean market is really dominated by a couple of very large chip makers. You know, we've got the likes of SK Hynix and Samsung Electronics. You know, these are massive corporations. And suddenly their profits, their earnings were just going absolutely ballistic. So, you know, Wall Street investors started to pile into the market and it was rising at such a clip. I mean, the graph is just astronomical. It just, you know, goes along at around about 2,500 for years on end, and then suddenly lurches up to around 9,000. So then the locals started to get on board this as well, and about a million South Koreans decided to borrow money so that they could get into this boom, which they've done. Unfortunately, about a month ago, things started to turn a little pear-shaped when, not long after the SpaceX launch, and there were questions about valuations and so forth, and whether or not the big artificial intelligence companies could maintain the level of expenditure they've got. So the share prices started to turn down. And as a result of that, a lot of the locals who had borrowed money to get into this boom had margin calls, couldn't meet the margin calls, had their stock sold from underneath them. And so the market's now down around about 28%.
Wild.
They had a couple of 5-minute breaks yesterday to just basically, you know, get everybody to calm down a little and take a deep breath. But so it's looking pretty volatile at the moment.
When the market falls a lot and they suspend trading, does anyone calm down in the period before they resume? Has that ever worked?
I don't think so, no, because they had to do several 5-minute stops yesterday.
So we've had these big impacts. Doesn't this show kind of the inherent volatility that comes with so much of our growth and investments in a sector where the advances are really rapid, but they're also companies working discreetly and very difficult to independently analyze what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, nobody had ever heard of Moonshot on Thursday or Kimi K3, and suddenly here we are, we're all very worried about it. But I guess the real concern here is the fact that, particularly with artificial intelligence, it's moving from a closed shop of very, very sophisticated corporations, all interconnected, a handful of them all interconnected with people throwing huge amounts of money at it. It's though it's going to be this artificial intelligence is going to be proprietary owned. It's going to be specialized. It's going to be owned by just a handful of companies that are going to control the whole thing. And now we've got this prospect of maybe it's just going to become another commodity. It'll be a bit like electric vehicles and how China's essentially taken control of the automobile market by going into electric vehicles. And most other countries, particularly America, is chugging along with good old-fashioned internal combustion engines. And this could be the same situation where you're moving from a tightly controlled market. Instead of just a handful of companies, this is going to be – it's open source. It's going to be just another commodity. And the problem that has, particularly for the stock market as we're seeing it at the moment, is that the valuations have been very, very high, primarily because that handful of companies have been throwing trillions of dollars in all directions. They've been throwing it at chip makers. They've been throwing it at data centers. They've been throwing it at the development of artificial intelligence, thinking that once we've got this all nailed down, we're going to be able to charge everybody around the world what we want to charge to get our returns back on the huge amount of money we've invested. And suddenly now it's maybe we're not going to be able to control the market. Maybe this stuff's just going to be everywhere and we're going to be up against companies and organizations that have developed this technology on their own at a fraction of the cost. So there's going to be a lot more supply out there for everybody to buy, and we're going to be competing against people who've paid hardly anything for it. How are we going to make money on this? And so I think that there's yet to be a reckoning of that kind of shift, and where investors go, I don't know that you are going to be able to recoup your money on this, and then we'll see a correction, I guess.
So Chinese chip maker CXMT made big waves last week. It's looking to raise almost $10 billion in a bid to go public on the Shanghai Exchange. These Chinese companies, CMXT, Moonshot, it seems like an almost existential threat to what's been really established major US tech titans that we are very invested in as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've had no choice but to invest in these things, and particularly with SpaceX. I mean, What we've experienced with SpaceX is that everybody has bent the rules, and as a result of the rules being bent, SpaceX was included into the NASDAQ main index and also into the Russell index. And what that means is, and probably a lot of people don't realize this, is that, you know, the world of investing is no longer dominated by, you know, people sitting around an office going, you know what, that looks like a good company. I might go down there and interview the chief executive and go through the shop floor and see how it all works. It's all done. It's automated. It's actually artificial intelligence. It's called passive investing. And, you know, if you want to invest, you don't know what to buy on the stock exchange, it's the ASX 200, you put your money into an exchange-traded fund and a computer will figure out, well, the biggest company on the exchange today is BHP, so most of your money is going to go there. The second biggest company is the Commonwealth Bank, so a little bit less will go there. And it'll gradually put your money over the entire 200 companies on the ASX 200. Now, as a result of these incredible valuations that were put forth and the fact that it was an IPO and then it was just suddenly put into the index, all the money, the computers, all the exchange-traded funds, all the passive investment funds have directed a huge amount of money into SpaceX purely by virtue of the fact of its weighting on the index.
We see this every year where the ASX 200, our flagship index, which tracks the value of the top 200 stocks, recalibrates. And it's like the English Premier League relegation, where a few get kicked out and a few high performers from below get put in. Those companies, then their share price goes up because everyone who's in these index-hugging funds, these passive funds, has to invest in them. We've seen that with SpaceX because they have essentially changed the rules to get them into these index really fast. Now we spoke to Alicia Barry on the pod last week about that slip in SpaceX's share price. Ian, you point out in your article something really interesting. The SpaceX share valuations are based on revenue rather than profit. How substantial is that difference?
It's massive. And the reason it's not based on profit, of course, is because SpaceX doesn't earn a profit. It doesn't deliver profits. And it's not likely to deliver one for a very, very long time. I mean, it's a grab bag of businesses. It's got the old Twitter, which is now called X, that platform. I'm not sure how much that kind of delivers in terms of profit. The only really profitable part of the business is the internet.
Starlink.
Yeah, Starlink. That's really the only profitable side of the business. I think the everything else doesn't make much money. They're throwing huge amounts of investment into artificial intelligence. But in terms of AI market share, SpaceX has got something like 3.5%. So it's
tiny. It's
not really a player in this field. Now, you know, it's managed to be the first off the mark with this, which is great for SpaceX and for Elon Musk, but not so good for the competitors and not so good for the people who've invested in it. But all the investment bankers out there have just lauded this company and said it's what a transformation. This is the best thing for civilization ever. And they've tried to value it based on revenue. Now, with profit, if you get what's known as a multiple, you know, let's say it's your company earns $1 million a year. An analyst will go, well, if it earns $1 million a year, the proper multiple is 15 times earnings. That's what the value is, because it'll take you 15 years of returns to basically justify the money you've put in. SpaceX doesn't earn any profit. So, well, what do we – we've got revenue here. And guess what the multiple is on – it's, you know – Up to 500 on some models. A couple of the investment banks are around about the 200. That means that it's going to take 203 years, right, for the revenue to justify, to pay back the money you've paid for the shares. You have to convert that revenue into profit at some stage. So if you're not going to convert, if it's going to take you a long time to convert it into profit, well, the 203 years could turn out to be a, you know, millennium or two, really.
All this stuff is speculative. This is not investment advice, but Ian, I'm pretty confident we're not going to be doing this pod together in 203 years.
No. And I think that's the whole trick to this. You know, you just keep pushing things further and further out into the future. I mean, some of the business plans for Elon Musk and SpaceX are to build data centers in space. It's incredible to see, you know, the euphoria, the mania that everyone gets swept up with in all of this. And, you know, it is quite visionary, but, you know, I've read a lot of visionary things in novels too, but I'm not sure that I'd want to put my money into it. And here we are. We've all got our money invested in it.
Ian, I'll see you on the Journalist for Mill, where we go up to inspect the space AI centres shortly.
Okay.
Look, we spend a lot of time talking about the challenges of getting young Australian families into the property market, but there's a growing sense that downsizing is an issue as well. This is where people are older, they perhaps don't want to have as much of a large house, perhaps the children have moved out, for Australians at the other end of the generational spectrum. We've discussed as well a lack of affordable options for downsizing and some of the data around that. What do you see about this linked problem where essentially, like, it is a market problem where some people have more housing than potentially they want or need, and others have less dwelling space or housing than they would like? How are we going to get appropriate supply to fix this particular problem?
Look, it is a real problem, and there's no doubt about it, because, you know, if you're, you know, at, you know, in retirement age, and you've decided, well, look, I've got a 3-bedroom house. It's on a fairly decent sized block of land. The kids have all gone. The grandkids come around every now and then. But, you know, I'm getting tired of mowing the lawns and, you know, beavering away in the garden. You know, I wouldn't mind going into a smaller place that was a lot less work intensive. But the problem you have then is, well, hang on, how much am I going to get for this house? Let's say it's 2 million. It's, you know, which is a lot of money, but how much am I going to pay for it to downsize? I'm going to pay 2.2 million for a smaller place. Then, there's all the other costs like stamp duty that come in on the top of that. So there is no incentive whatsoever for people to move out of their home, because why would you take on more money, or even just, you know, you're going to pay most of the money you get for a smaller place, and then you pay stamp duty on the top of it all? You might as well just use the money you would have paid for stamp duty, or the extra money you'd pay for a smaller place, to get somebody in to do the garden for you. The incentives aren't there at all, and it's something that governments are going to have to address at some stage. Now, whether it's some kind of building program that comes in to cater for that end of the market, or whether it's a revamp of the taxation system, which some state governments have tried to do without success. Nobody likes tax changes, so it's really hard to get any kind of tax reform through, even if it's sensible.
It's interesting that this might be one that in some ways the market sorts out. I was at an property developers conference recently, and they're talking about where I am here in Victoria. The only two things that they can make financially work on larger scale is purpose-built student accommodation, PABSA, and reasonably luxurious downsizer apartments. So 2 and 3 bedroom apartments, well located, extremely high level of finishing, and in good spots, in suburbs where the land is expensive. These are the things they can make financially, whereas putting up buildings that have 2 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, they can't make that work. They can't sell them for enough for what the market will bear to make it profitable. So there's an element that might shift over time as the market works itself out. But without fixing stamp duty, which is a huge impost, I did the calculator this morning. If you're in Sydney, which is our most expensive, but not far off it anymore, property market, and you had a $2 million purchase, which sounds outrageous, but is barely above the median house price, you would pay about $100,000 in stamp duty. That is a massive impost on moving. There's also other land taxes and transaction costs and things like that. But like you said, that is an upfront cost that really makes it more difficult to free up this space. And it will be interesting to see how we go about tackling this, because I don't know that the government's recent property aim tax changes will make much of a difference for this particular problem.
No. And, you know, $100,000, you know, that buys you a lot of help around the house. If your concern is that the place is too big for you and, you know, you want to move into a smaller place, if you're in a good location and you're not going to be in as good a location, where's the incentive here? And there's got to be some kind of incentive to do it. You know, if you've got a big place, you would think, well, somebody with a growing family needs this more than me. And so it's worth more than what I'm after. I'm only just after a small place. So you would expect to pay less, free up some capital for your retirement, and, you know, happy days. But it doesn't work out that way at all. It works out that you're going to actually, at, you know, maybe break even, maybe a tiny bit better off, but there's, you know, the stamp duty impost is such that it just doesn't make it worthwhile. And it's interesting that it's stamp duty, particularly in New South Wales and probably Victoria as well, and possibly less so for some of the other states, but stamp duty in New South Wales makes up the bulk of the state government's revenue. It is just vital for the state government's revenue. So there's not a great incentive for reform in this kind of atmosphere.
And it is changing the market. So ownership is a big issue. Recent data from KPMG shows the owner-occupier rate for Greater Sydney has dropped to levels not seen since the 1950s. You are seeing this shift in the market where fewer people are owning houses or, you know, paying the bank to own the house. We are seeing more people renting for longer. And part of that, you know, is what we've been discussing today about an inability to shift and to free up properties that could be sold. So, you know, this stuff has impact far beyond the people that we might think are just affected, being perhaps older Australians in houses too large. It actually has a real flow down the line result.
Yeah, look, there's been the intergenerational reports have noted this as well, that people are buying houses later in life. And that then flows through every cohort. So every, you know, decile, every 10 years, if you take the cohorts in that particular measurement, each one of them, as you look at it down the line, the curve moves further and further out to the point where people are now retiring with mortgages and fairly substantial mortgages. Now, it's probably the mortgage payments that are going to define whether you sell your house or not. And determine whether you sell your house or not, because you can't afford the repayments anymore, rather than an incentive to actually move into a smaller place. So there's a lot of really interesting demographics going on here, and a lot of this gets down to the incredible rise in real estate values in the Australian market over the past 30 to 40 years, which of course, as we've spoken many times, has been, you know, turbocharged really by those tax breaks, the negative gearing and the capital gains tax discounts that, you know, are trying to be unwound at the moment, but which is facing some fairly stiff opposition.
Now, we mentioned KPMG, the consulting firm that has to have the word embattled in front of it, has a new boss just been announced. John Sams is the former chief financial officer. He will assume the top job at KPMG Australia in what has to be described as the worst period I can think of to be a consulting firm boss.
The words poison chalice come to mind, are they?
We have sought more information from KPMG because they are a partnership model, which means that normally the chair and the CEO have to be voted in. They run campaigns. They have candidates. This is how this works. Instead, it seems like in these troubled times, the board they have, which has an interim chair who has not been voted in, appears to have installed someone using after a selection process, and they'll probably seek a mandate in retrospect.
I mean, it's interesting, the model, the partnership model. I think that is really going to come under the spotlight because they are partnerships. They are not subject to the Corporations Act. And so as a result of that, the penalties that are incorporated in the Corporations Act do not apply to the wrongdoings within partnerships. So it's a very, and these are not just, you know, a law firm or an accounting firm with, you know, two or three employees. These are massive operations, global operations. And I think you might find that in the next little while, governments around the world will be looking at that model and trying to figure out how do we rectify this situation.
I do think that the likelihood of these massive partnerships that have up to 10,000 people working for them and up to 1,000 partners still operating under New South Wales company law is remote. I think there'll be some change there. But we'll see. There are more hearings scheduled into KPMG next month in Parliament. I think we'll find out more then.
Looking forward to it.
That's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send us a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Ian, lovely to chat. Catch you later.
See you, Dan.